Hi, this is Brian Reardon with the S Corporation Association. We've got Tom Nichols with Tom. I can never remember all the names in your law firm. What are they?
Meisner, Tierney, Fisher and Nichols.
Yeah, up in Milwaukee. Tom is an expert on all things S Corp, and he's been the chair of our advisory committee for a long, long time. And we thought that a call focusing on the policy response that's taken place to date to the whole coronavirus issue, and focusing in particular on a couple different items, would be particularly helpful for members and the trade associations that we worked with. And first, let me thank all the trade association folks that are on with the help of the letter that we did. We got over 120 trade groups on it. I thought it hit really key points that, frankly, the Phase 3 bill responded to. You know, we asked them to be, you know, get it of scale and have it properly targeted. And the bill's massive, so it's the same size as the challenge that we face. And I think some of the provisions in there, hopefully, knock on wood, are going to be particularly helpful to the private businesses around there. We do have a PowerPoint, so if you want to follow along, I sent it out earlier. I'm on page 2, which is the disclaimer. I am not an attorney, and this is not legal advice. It's for general information only. Tom is an attorney, and you can actually rely on what he says. With my stuff, you have to take it with a grain of salt. If you go to slide 3, the agenda, I'll do a brief overview. I want to talk about the mandated leave details that were part of the Phase 2 bill, because I think that's still something that a lot of employers are not focused on. So we'll hit the highlights there. We'll talk about the delayed tax filing and payment that Treasury announced, as well as the delayed payroll tax payments that are part of Phase 3, and then some of the other tax provisions. And then most of the call we're going to spend on this new small business loan program, the paycheck protection provisions or program that is part of the Phase 3 bill. Tom's going to do that part, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. And hopefully we knock this all out in 30 or 40 minutes and then have lots of time for interaction with folks, because, as I said, I do want to hear from folks and hear what they have to say. It's this is a moving target, as you're well aware, and when, you know, it's getting the input on how things are going is particularly helpful. So, with regard to the challenge, this is a chart from last week. The Vox people put it out. It gives you an idea of just how remarkable the initial UI claim report from last Thursday was. As you can see, the report showed 3.283 million new initial claims. That's an increase of 3 million people from the previous week. It's also about 5 times the previous high that's ever been recorded. Even if you go back all the way back to the Great Depression, we've never had anything of this scale before. The responses, particularly at the state level, you know, in Virginia, we just got a stay-at-home order, have really just shut down the economy. And so I personally have never experienced anything like this. I don't think anybody has on the phone. And so everything, all the responses, I think the agencies and Congress and everybody are doing what they can, but it's also very much an experiment. This is not something that we've tried before, so we're going to have to see how it works out. If looking forward, Morgan Stanley last week put out an estimate that they expect in the second quarter the economy is going to contract 30%, unemployment is going to rise to 12.8%. That means 15 million people total, including the 3 million from last week, are going to lose their jobs. If you think about that in terms of per state per week, you're talking about 60,000 jobs per state per week, or 12,000 jobs per state per day. The unemployment agencies in all these states are absolutely overwhelmed. I was reading some articles about Florida and elsewhere where people can't get through. That's going to have to change because, as you'll see, much of the response from Congress is focused on UI and having an effective unemployment system out there to help people when they lose their jobs. But the bottom line is that, you know, the response is having an unprecedented impact. And the response from Congress and the Fed and Treasury has to be of the same scale. So what have they done to date? We're on slide 6. We've had 3 different bills pass Congress. Phase 1 was $8 billion directly related or directly targeted at first responders, hospitals, the people who need the supplies to make sure that they can take care of folks with the virus. The second bill was passed on March 18th. It included mandatory paid leave that we'll talk about, additional funding for healthcare providers, coverage for COVID-19 testing. So if people get tested, their insurance will cover it, increased UI funding, and some other things. And then the big daddy was just last Friday, the president signed the phase three bill, and that's just a massive bill. It's $2 trillion worth of funding for families and businesses, and includes direct payments to families and expanded UI benefits. It's got the about $350 billion to healthcare professionals and, you know, institutions like hospitals, et cetera. Small and large business loan programs, and Tom will talk about the small business loan program here. Significant tax benefits, and then many, many other provisions. And one of the challenges that I'm having these days, if you go to slide 7, is kind of getting keeping track of all these different programs and how they all interrelate, because there's a lot of overlap. It's almost like what Congress is doing is taking the shotgun approach here, where, you know, is the shotgun shell, it's got lots of little pebbles in there, and you just hope that one or two of those pebbles is effective for each employer and for each worker. This schematic helps me think about it a little bit. So the red stuff on the left, that's the direct payments to families and children. You can see they got the family rebates of $1,200 per adult, $500 per child. It phases out at certain income levels. Those people will also, if they're unemployed or if they get fired, get increased unemployment benefits. As we were discussing, the standard benefit is around $400 a week nationally. That's the average. They've juiced that up by an additional $600 per week, which means that, and that goes for 4 months. So if you're laid off and you're running average, you're going to get $4,000 a month under UI for the next 4 months. It's a pretty potent amount of money, and it should be able to make sure that people can pay their mortgage, pay their bills, continue to do the things that they need to do to stay solvent so that we can get to the other end. The center of the business response, you know, you can see on the right side, there's a lot of different business responses, but the center is the Paycheck Protection Program. That's the small business loan program that Tom's going to talk about. The challenge with seeing that is that it, you know, in addition to that, you've got an employee retention credit that employers get if they hold on to their employers. Well, you can't do both the loan program and the employee retention program. They also passed a payroll tax payment delay through the end of the year that I'll talk about. Well, again, you can't do that and get loans forgiven under the small business loan program. And then, of course, you've got the big business loan program that's going to be run out of Treasury and the Fed. You can't do both of those either. So there's a lot of interaction here that people are going to have to work through. This is kind of a moving target. And, you know, when I did the disclaimer at the beginning, I was kind of serious. Some of this stuff, we're going to just try to give you the best idea of how it's going to work. But some of the details may change over time as we learn more about them. So Congress took the shotgun approach, up to businesses and workers to decide which program is best for them. For this call, we're going to focus on four things. One, the new mandated sick and leave benefits in phase two. Two, the delay of the tax and filing payments by Treasury. Three, the delayed payroll tax payments in phase three. And then four, Tom's going to talk about the new small business loan program. Let's talk about mandated leave. The phase two bill includes a new mandated leave policy and applies to employers with fewer than 500 employees. And let me repeat that because that's kind of odd. Instead of applying to bigger businesses, it in fact applies to businesses with fewer than 500 employees. That's the cost side of things. The flip side is that the benefit is that the costs of these mandated leave programs are offset through refundable tax credits applied against the employer portion of payroll taxes. The program begins April 1st, and it runs through the end of the year. Covered employees are required to post notice of these benefits. The DOL just put out the notice, and I've got a link here on this the slide deck, but they just put it out last couple days. I'm not really sure where you're going to post it since all the workplaces have been shut down, but unless told otherwise, I think what you have to do is take that poster and stick it up with all the other DOL posters you have at your workplace. Here it says household employees may be covered under the new sick leave program, but that's not true. I went back and checked. In fact, a nice attorney that I was talking to sent me a note and said, no, it's clear that the only employers that are covered are those that are engaged in commerce and those in, government, et cetera. So household employees are not covered under this program. You don't have to worry about that. Slide 10, four employees who take sick, because there's six different categories of reason for leave. The first three are associated with the employee themselves is either sick or they've been quarantined or they've been advised by their doctor to stay home. Under those circumstances, they're entitled to 2 weeks or 80 hours of paid leave at their regular pay, applicable minimum wage, but it's capped at $511 per day or $5,110 per 2 weeks. So that's for if the employee is sick themselves or they think they might be sick, they've been told to stay home, they've been advised to quarantine themselves by a doctor, et cetera, then they get this higher rate of two-week paid leave. If, on the other hand, they're caring for another individual who might be in the first three categories, or if their kids are home because school's been canceled like it's been canceled everywhere, or the daycare that they use is shut down, or this is kind of an odd one, where the employee's experiencing something substantially similar condition, which I think means that they think they have the virus, but it turns out that they don't. Then they get 2 weeks, but instead of at the full rate of pay, it's two-thirds their regular pay, or $200 a day, $2,000 over 2 weeks. Then they have the extended mandated leave, and this is for employees who have kids, they're home, school's canceled, daycare's canceled. They and also if they've been employed for at least 30 days, then they qualify for an additional 10 weeks. So in addition to those 2 weeks, they get another 10 weeks at two-thirds their regular pay. Again, it's capped $200 a day or $12,000 over the total 12-week period. We're on slide 13, the mandated leave tax credits. This is the good part. You get a dollar-for-dollar offset against payroll taxes for leave benefits paid by employees. The qualifying wages are those paid to an employee who takes leave under the Act for a qualified reason, up to the appropriate per diem and aggregate payment caps. That just means that you can't deduct more than the $511 or $200 per day caps that they have in there. In most cases, the paid leave is simply subtracted from the payroll tax payments you would otherwise make to Treasury. Where there's a refund owed, the IRS promises to send the refund as quickly as possible. They'll also, and this is an interesting thing, the tax credits also extend to the amounts paid or incurred to maintain health insurance coverage. So the easiest way to think about that is if you have a plan for all your employees and it costs you about $10,000 per employee, and one of your employee takes this extended leave and it lasts about a tenth of the year, then you would be able to deduct, in addition to the paid leave, you would be able to deduct one-tenth of your costs for the health insurance plan or $1,000. So it's not just the paid leave that you're paying them, it's also the prorated amount of the health insurance coverage that you're paying for them. A couple examples. These are, the DOL put these out as part of their guidance. Eligible employees pay eligible employer pays $5,000 in sick leave and is otherwise required to deposit $8,000 in payroll taxes. The employer can use up to $5,000 of the $8,000 in taxes it was going to deposit for making qualified leave payments. You would only, in that case, deposit $3,000 in payroll taxes. The second example shows where you have a refund. An eligible employer pays $10,000 in sick leave but only has to pay $8,000 in payroll taxes. In that case, all $8,000 you keep, and then you you get an accelerated credit for the remaining $2,000. The equivalent child care leave and sick leave credit amounts are available to self-employed individuals. How they go about making sure that self-employed individuals follow the rules and all that, I'll leave it up to them, but this is available to self-employed individuals as well as regular employees. We're on slide 15, exemptions. Small businesses with fewer than 50 employees are eligible for an exemption from the leave requirements. Where the requirement would jeopardize, and this is for the extended leave, by the way, where it would jeopardize the ability of the business to continue to act as a going concern. So DOL put out three specific examples of how this might apply. And the first is the provision of paid leave would result in the business's expenses exceeding the revenues. So in these days where you don't have a lot of revenues coming in, you might have paid leave exceeding what you have coming in. That would be a reason to get an exemption. The absence of the employee would entail a substantial risk to the financial health or operational capabilities of the business. That is, they're an essential employee. In other words, you might be able to get an exemption then. And then the third one is there are insufficient workers who are able, willing, qualified to fill in for the employee. Again, sort of an essential employee category. And so you don't automatically get the exemption, but if you fit those facts and circumstances, you might be able to get an exemption. The other category is where you have employees where you're a healthcare provider, like a hospital or a first responder. In that case, you could get an exemption and you wouldn't have to participate in this program. Notice requirements. You got to post the notice no later than 7 days after enactment of the new law. New law was enacted on Friday, so you got till Friday to get it up there. The actual poster is linked to there, as well as some nice guidance from the DOL. Rules are in effect from April 1st through the end of the year. So this is a new benefit, new mandate. People need to be aware of it. I think a lot of the employers on the phone will be covered by this, so they need to be aware of the rules. If you go to these two links at the DOL, it tells you just about everything you need to know. The second thing I want to talk about is the delayed tax payments and tax filing. I think everybody's aware of this at this point, but just wanted to flag it. Treasury announced back on March 18th that they're going to delay tax payment of income taxes. This is just income taxes for corporations and individuals until July 15th. They capped the deferred taxes at $10 million for corps, $1 million for individuals, estates, and trusts. I might have sent them a note pointing out that they were once again forgetting about S-corps and partnerships and not treating them on the same level as they were treating the C-corps. I also might point out that privately held C-corps really don't employ that many people. Most of the employment is either in public companies or private S-corps partnerships, et cetera. So if they're really going for employers, they needed to level that out. They listen. I'm not sure that they're just listening to me. I think they got a lot of feedback about people worried about confusing multiple dates and the caps and all that. And so what they ended up doing was a few days later, they just delayed everything. So they delayed both filing and payment, and it's for all income taxes for 2019. So you don't have to do anything. There's no action required on the part of taxpayers. You know, instead of April 15 being tax day this year, it's going to be July 15th. The nice thing is that many... Yeah, Tom?
I was just going to say that they have now just recently expanded that to include gift taxes.
Oh, well, there you go. How nice is that? Many states are following suit. So the AICPA has a really nice list. If you haven't paid attention, go click on their list. That'll tell you which states have delayed tax payments. So, for instance, in Virginia, I think they've delayed tax filing till June 1st. They've done something until June 1st. I think it's filing, if not the payment. But the AICPA has a very nice list that includes all of those. Phase 3 payroll tax delay. As you saw from my little schematic, there's a lot in Phase 3. But I did want to flag this because it starts immediately, right? Phase 3 bill allows the delay of the employer's share of payroll taxes through the end of 2020. So it runs from the date of enactment, which was last Friday, March 27th, through the end of the year. It allows employers to forego paying the employer's share, and it gives employers 2 years, 21 and 22, to repay the payroll taxes deferred. And I think it works strictly half. So whatever you delay paying this year, you have to pay half of it in 2021 and then half of it in 2022. Business, and this is key, this is something you got to be aware of. Businesses that have loans forgiven under the new small business section, loan program that Tom's going to talk about, are ineligible for this relief. So if you think about taking out a loan with the new Paycheck Protection Program, don't delay your payroll taxes. You have to keep paying your payroll taxes. It's also not really clear how the payroll tax delay coordinates with the credits that you get under the mandated leave program. In other words, if under the mandated leave program, you're deducting the costs of mandated leave that you're paying to some of your employees from the payroll taxes, and you don't have any payroll tax liability. Well, how does that work if you've already delayed paying the payroll taxes to the end of the year under this program? My simple answer is that you would get a lot of refunds under that scenario, but I think at some point Treasury needs to make clear that is the result that they're looking for. So anyway, a couple of interactions that people need to be aware of. There are other helpful tax provisions in the bill. These are items, frankly, that were in our letter, so it's nice to see them included in the bill. The NOL carrybacks, I know a lot of companies, that's going to be helpful to them. I was just talking with a couple companies today where the loss limitation relief is going to be particularly helpful. The modification of the 163J interest deductibility cap, it bumps it up from a 30% cap to a 50% cap. That should be helpful, particularly at a time where revenues are down and earnings are probably down. And then our friends got their qualified improvement property fix, the technical fix done after several years of trying really, really hard. So those are the things I wanted to cover. I'm trying to do this quickly so we can get Tom on here to talk about the substance of these loan programs. And with that, I think we're on slide 20. And Tom, I'll turn it over to you.
Sounds good, Brian. 20 is just an introductory, and then I'm going to kind of try to go pretty quickly through these slides. I should mention that my plan is not to cover everything that's in these slides. We just don't have time to do that, but hopefully they will be available as a resource, obviously, after we're done. So everybody knows this is only these loan forgiveness provisions are only applicable to small businesses. There's a 500-employee limit. There are a couple of industries that might get might be able to use higher numbers. Individual contractors can also be covered. And that, frankly, would take an hour on its own. So I'm not going to be dealing with independent contractors here as it relates to the independent contractors qualifying. Affiliation rules, there again, I'm on slide 22. They're very significant for some businesses and irrelevant for a lot of others. I'll just list it on 22. Availability of loans. You can also refinance your old loans, but these loans are going to be available through June 30, 2020. And once I get to slide 24, I'm going to slow down a little bit, and because there now we're going to talk about exactly how these things work. And there's a term that's used both in the loan availability rules and in the loan forgiveness rules, and it's called payroll costs. And there are two categories of things that are included. I want to get to the things that are excluded too, but slide 24 deals with things that are included. The stuff on the left is wages, sick leave, various other things, and compensation, retirement benefits, health care. Things that you would expect. In general, it seems to cover what you would think would be covered. That's the listing on the left. A listing on the right, and here I think I'm reasonably comfortable with the conclusion that not only are we covering in payroll costs the amounts that you're paying to employees, but you're also covering amounts that you're paying to independent contractors that make less than $100,000 a year. That is problematic. How do you calculate how much they're making if all you're paying in them is a portion of their compensation? There are a number of issues that come up in connection with that, but that, for some businesses, could be a critical component. And I should mention that the term payroll costs is critical both from the size of the loan you can get and also the amounts that you can get forgiven. So just remember that that's an important slide, the definition of payroll costs. Excluded payroll costs, slide 25, is also a fairly important one. First of all, you exclude item number one there. You exclude all compensation over and above $100,000 on an annualized basis. That one's not shocking. And so that one doesn't surprise me, that one, and I think I see how that fits in. But I think I've gotten a number of questions as to whether or not compensation below that is covered, and I think the answer should be yes. I don't see language suggesting otherwise. The next one is more problematic to me. It essentially says taxes imposed under FICA, the Railroad Retirement Tax, and withholding during the covered period. And that's awkward for me. I'm not quite sure how this is going to end up fitting in. You end up, when you're calculating your base for taking out the loan, they say during the covered period in this provision that the covered period would be from February 15 to June 2020. You take that out of the base for the covered loan. You also apparently don't get reimbursed for that. And so as a consequence, let's say the amount of forgiveness that you would otherwise have is, it only consists of payroll costs, and you've got $100,000 that you're paying to 10 employees during the covered period for forgiveness. If, let's say, $30,000 of that is paid in the form of employee FICA and employee federal withholding, it looks to me like you only get a credit for the $70,000. You've got a budget for the fact that you're going to have to pay that extra $30,000. You get the credit for the, you get forgiveness for the $70,000, but that extra $20,000, I'm sorry, $30,000, is essentially going to have to, you're going to end up being on the hook for that. So I would, that one I'm not quite sure, that one kind of goes clank for me, but I thought I would highlight it because it presumably is going to have to be worked through, and it will be a factor when you're calculating your numbers. So employees whose residence outside the United States are excluded, and then what Brian was talking about, item 4 and 5, qualified sick leave wages and family leave wages are out, but remember, those are you're supposed to get a credit for those. Sooner or later, you're supposed to get a credit for those, so that you can understand why that's there. The next slide is 26, and I hear I'm not going to go into all this detail. In general, the program is fairly favored, and the only one that I'll point out is number 5, that there's a risk weighting for banks that participate in this program, a risk weighting of 0%, which of course is going to help their capital ratios. The only other thing that I would point out on this slide, and that is the authorized commitment is $349 billion. I can't imagine how this whole program, based on all of the provisions I've seen, and just I can't imagine that they're going to fit all of this within $349 billion. And what that does to me and for the clients I'm advising is, and that is that you want to get in the queue for this program sooner rather than later, because if at the end of the day people start to run up against limits, you want to make sure yours are in there. My guess is they'll run up against the limit, and my guess is they're going to raise the limit. But that, you know, that there's a couple of guesses in there. Next slide, the maximum loan amount, and here's where that term payroll costs comes into play again. You essentially take average monthly payment costs during the 1 year period ending before the date on which the loan is made. So you're calculating monthly payments. And you do that, and your cap is that those monthly payments times 2.5. So you're roughly 2.5 months worth is your maximum amount. And that's based just on payroll costs. There are other items that are forgivable. We'll talk about them later, rent and utilities and mortgage interest, but they're not included in the cap, so that essentially the loan forgiveness and the loan forgiveness period is only 8 weeks, and you're getting, so that's roughly 2 months, actually a little less, and the, so you take your payroll costs for your average ones during that 1 year period, do 2.5 times that, and that extra half a month, because you've only got 2 months worth of forgiveness, that extra half a month is, if you're in a steady state, you have the same expenses year in and year out, that extra half a month would be there and available to cover rent, utilities, and mortgage interest. But you can see it's mechanical the way this works, and for some people this won't be a big issue. For other people, just based on when they pay things, it could be quite problematic. There's an overall cap of $10 million, and then there's special rules, but I think that's probably enough on the maximum loan amount. But I would remember the 2.5 times monthly payroll costs for the one-year period ending on the taking out the loan. Then, as far as allowable uses, there's where I've kind of been talking about this stuff beforehand, but allowable uses, here's the list. And you've got payroll costs, and they essentially used exactly the same definition. So all the good things and bad things about the definition that I said before, they apply to this. They apply to the allowable uses. Then you've got B and C on slide 28 here. You know, group health care benefits and commissions and similar compensation. Seems to me all of those things are payroll costs, except that now what they're you would. B and C would presumably include not only what would be within payroll costs up to $100,000, you'd also be picking up any of those items in excess of $100,000, which could be significant in some circumstances. Then you've got payments on mortgage obligations. And here, the statute is a little schizophrenic. In the mortgage forgiveness rules, a mortgage obligation is a obligation that's secured by a mortgage on real or personal property. And I've always thought a mortgage obligation is secured by a mortgage on real property. And so, and it may very well be that what they're thinking of is that a mortgage is, you know, a security agreement, and it would also cover, for example, a general business security agreement on inventory and accounts receivable for, let's say, for a line of credit. But whatever it is, my best guess is that it probably is going to be interpreted that broadly. In other words, you don't necessarily have to be a real estate owner to qualify, but I don't know, because it's not defined for purposes of the allowable uses. It is defined for purposes of the loan forgiveness. This is the obligation that you're getting the interest loan amounts for and you're getting forgiveness for must be incurred before February 15, 2020, so you can't go out and borrow money now. Then you've got rent and utilities, which we've already talked about, and that's, you know, the big four: payroll costs, rent, utilities, and interest, and mortgage interest. And then you've also got, in terms of actually taking the loan out, you can also get interest on other obligations, but here again, other obligations that were in place before February 15. And then you've also got other SBA uses. So there's some symmetry, or there's some identity between the amounts that you can take the loan out for and the amounts you can get forgiveness for, but it is not identical. The loan terms, here, they're fairly favorable loan terms. I'll just, you know, in particular, there's no recourse. There's no requirement to obtain, that you have to obtain credit elsewhere, no personal guarantee, no collateral. The exception is that there might be a shareholder, member, or partner could be liable if the shareholder, member, or partner uses the covered loan proceeds for a purpose not authorized under Clause 1. So that's something that could presumably trigger personal liability, but I think that probably won't be an issue. You know, for most people, they're just going to be careful about it, and that'll be an easy way for them to use the funds. I would, on the certification, it is, there is a certification that's actually in the statute. Take a look at, on page 30, the certification. It's just the first one that makes me a little nervous, because there are some companies, you know, if you're in the grocery delivery business, for example, you might not be in a position to make the certification that the uncertainty of current economic conditions makes necessary the loan request to support the ongoing operations of the eligible recipient. So I don't think that certification was intended to be a real difficult hurdle to get over, but I would watch for that, especially when you're talking about companies that are actually doing okay, or maybe even responding to the needs that are triggered by the COVID crisis. Loan forgiveness terms. I think we've kind of talked about all of these beforehand. Covered period, the 8-week period, we've talked about that, but it's important to recognize that 8-week period, you know, that's a 2-month period. It's not the 2.5. It's an 8-week period, and it starts when the loan is taken out. Notice also that everything that is being reimbursed in the terms of loan forgiveness. Now we've moved from taking out the loan to things that would be forgivable. The items that are forgivable are mortgage obligations incurred before February 15, leases incurred before February 15, utilities for service that was incurred before February 15. I don't know what that means if you change locations or whatever, but presumably we'll end up getting some indication on that. Loan forgiveness terms, and then we move. Then there's a chart here on slide 32, and here I've kind of indicated this stuff before. You look at the stuff on the left, that's what you can take out the loan for. You look at the stuff on the right, that's the stuff that for which you can actually get mortgage forgiveness. You've got two other things, and I know we want to leave some time in here, but there are two fairly complicated things, but I want to just hit the highlights on them, and then I'll be done here. You've got two things that could essentially put a cap on, or I should say reduce the amount of loan forgiveness. So you've got really two things that start out. You've got a cap on the amount of loans based on that 2.5 monthly payroll costs. You've also got a cap on the amount that can be forgiven based on your actual amounts of the four big categories, payroll costs, rent, utilities, mortgage interest, during the covered period. Now, once you've got that cap, then you're going to end up getting potentially a reduction based on, number one, the first reduction is a reduction in workforce. You get to choose a 4.5-month period from the beginning of 2019 or a 2-month period at the beginning of 2020. You get to choose that, unless you're a seasonal employer. And then you end up taking the average FTE equivalents during the 8-week covered period. That's the period for which you're going to get forgiveness. Over that, your average number on a monthly basis during your testing period, to the extent that your numerator is less, then obviously you're going to get a cap. This can't increase your forgiveness, loan forgiveness, but it couldn't obviously get back and reduce it. Then you've got also the reduction in salary wages. And to be honest, we could have a seminar for at least an hour talking about the various things that are in here. There are a couple of reasons why. The language is way at the end of the bill, and frankly, I think by the time people were drafting this, they were exhausted. And so as a consequence, there are unavoidably some issues that are in the reduction in salary and wages. It seems to be being applied on an employee-by-employee basis. Couple of things in here that I can't tell you for sure, but I think they're the case. And if an employee quit, for example, earlier in the year and you just never rehired him or you replaced him or her with somebody else, presumably that's not going to have an impact, even though there will be a reduction in wages. The comparison is between and here's where the language is very difficult. The comparison is between total salaries or wages of the employee during the covered period versus total salaries or wages during the most recent full quarter. Well, a covered period, as we've talked about, is 8 weeks. The most recent full calendar quarter is 13 weeks. And so obviously you're going to pay somebody less during 8 weeks than you're going to pay them during 13 weeks. I don't think that's what they intended, but yeah, I could certainly interpret the language to mean that. And I've just kind of touched the surface of the issues with respect to that one, but that one's one that is going to, hopefully we'll get more guidance and that guidance will be constructive instead of destructive. But that one, obviously, if you're not keeping everybody at full salary, that's obviously one that everybody is going to have to be looking at pretty carefully. Then there's a cure. process that if you do something, if you get cure things by June 30, 2020, you might be able to eliminate either the reduction in force or the reduction in salary wages, either one of those or both of those reductions from the overall loan forgiveness. I don't know how these would work, and you can see it, my questions right at the after the first one, where reduction in workforce, it says, if you read the language, which I've got quoted at the top, not later than June 30, the has eliminated the reduction. So, okay, if you hire somebody on June 30, 2020, to bring your workforce back up to snuff, does that do the trick? And then if you've hired them on June 30 and you fire them on July 1, 2020, is that somehow problematic? I would think it would be, but I don't know what that language means. Eliminated the reduction, no, not later than June 30, 2020. And then the same, there are similar issues as with respect to the reduction in salary and wages. That one seems a little more workable, but I'm not sure exactly what you need to do. If you raise their salary, if you raise that particular employee's salary back up on June 30, is that enough, or do you have to go backwards and essentially pay them the same amount all the way back to when you lowered their compensation to begin with? There's also language, well, and that provision is difficult to work with to begin with, and I should probably just leave it at that. The second one I think probably applies on an employee by employee basis. So I've got only one other point. I'm going to skip the application process. There obviously will be one. And I'm going to focus just on the last item I'm going to talk about is the income exclusion on page 37. So there it's clear in the Act itself that the loan forgiveness is excluded from gross income. So if I've got, let's say I'm in business and I operate on exactly break even throughout the entire year, but during this 8-week period, I've got $100,000 of expenses that end up borrowing and then having that loan forgiven. If I have $100,000 and I'm break even, as I say, so I've got net taxable income of zero at the end of the year, all of the things being equal, but then I've got this $100,000 of income, of loan, that I've used to pay deductible expenses, I think the way this works is that $100,000 of loan that is now forgiven is not income to me, but that $100,000 of expenses that I used that loan to pay for would still be deductible. I'm not 100% sure of this, but there's a chance that we've just created an artificial or a phantom $100,000 net operating loss for this person that has been working literally on a $0 taxable income basis throughout the entire year. I'm not saying that's true, but I'm not saying it's not true. I'm pointing out the issue. So, Brian, I think I went a little over. I'll shut up now.
No, that was excellent, very thorough. We appreciate you doing it, Tom. So now is the time we hope to hear from folks. If you want to ask a question, just hit *6 to unmute your lines and ask the question, and we're here. While I'm thinking of it, I did get a note from one of our friends who pointed out that with the DOL guidance on the mandated leave program, if you're an employer of 50 employees or under, you can self-certify that you meet any of those three conditions that they've outlined in their guide. So it's not something where you need to get the blessing of DOL or anybody else. You can just simply self-certify. Yeah, if I provide this benefit, it's going to endanger my business, is in effect what you're saying. So that's particularly helpful. But in terms of questions and other things, folks, *6, unmute your line, let us know. Got to be some questions out there.
And just one question on the rent. Sorry, on the rent calculation, is there a period of time? So I know obviously there's a period of time in this 2.5 months for payroll, but what is the period of time on the rent that would be included and potentially forgive?
During the, it would be, this Tom Nichols again, it's during the covered period. It would be rent, and there's language in the covered period in the explanation or in the in the loan forgiveness provision that uses both the word paid and incurred. So the only thing I can say for sure is that assuming you've got room under your 2.5 times monthly payroll cost cap, assuming you've got room there to get the rent forgiven, in your loan so as to get the rent forgiven, you've got to be able to use that rent if you both paid the rent and incurred the rent during the 8-week covered period. But if there is any uncertainty, this might be one of those things where you might coordinate with the landlord to pay the rent maybe, on the day after the covered period starts rather than right before the covered period, because right now they talk in terms of both paid and incurred. Statute does.
Thank you.
I have two questions on the FTE equivalent. So for the 19-week period, then I would assume it's going to be 760 hours that we're doing, and for the 8-week, 320, it would just be by a 40, just simply breaking them up. But on a secondary, what about an owner that is an employee of the corporation? Do we count them?
And that's an excellent question, but at the end of the day, if you're talking about a corp, an S-corp or a C-corp, I don't think there's much question that I would think that you would just literally be treating all employees the same. There's nothing in these provisions that essentially says, well, but we're not going to count compensation to owners. Now, they've given the size of this program and how much money is going out the door to begin with, I can't rule out the possibility that they will say that there should be some related party exceptions for qualification. I mean, another example of that is rent. A lot very common arrangement is where you've got a manufacturing concern and you pay out rent to essentially to an LLC solely owned by you or solely owned by your family. There again, is that rent covered? I think there's nothing in the statute that says it's not. And the same thing would be true for employees of a corporation. If you're talking about partners, there's fairly strong, at least IRS positioning out there that says that partners in a partnership cannot be employees, so that I wouldn't be surprised if that they might not qualify.
Yeah, I'm more considering officers of a corporation.
Are they getting a W-2? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
I'm not quite sure I see why they wouldn't be included in the subject to the $100,000 cap. There's nothing in the statute or there's nothing in this bill that would suggest that you don't count them same as anybody else.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I have a question, Tom, regarding the 500 affiliate, the employees, the 500 affiliate rule. When is the measurement date?
That's a good question. The honest answer is I don't know offhand. That's covered under the SBA rules. That one you probably can get a good answer for, because I'm sure that, there have been a lot of people applying for SBA loans, and there's got to be some way that the banks figure out. I'm sure they don't, stand in your HR department to make absolutely sure you're under or over the requirement. They've got to have some type of a date that they check, and I'm assuming that analysis and that determination is going to continue to be made the same way it is under current SBA loans.
Okay, because I'm thinking about employees that cycle in and out of the system in a manufacturing setting where, maybe we issue 700 W-2s in the year, but in fact, at any one time, we would only have 400 people working.
Well, unfortunately, there is actual separate language in the bill, which might be problematic for you. If you go to slide 21, it says the term right at the bottom. And this is one of the provisions in the bill itself. The term employee includes individuals employed on a full-time, part-time, or other basis. And that suggests to me that if I've got 10 full-time employees, I've got 10 employees. If I've got 20 part-time employees, I've got 20 employees. So that
Okay.
Part-time versus full-time could be a big deal there.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm Bob Dickinson. A couple of things for the part of the presentation that you had. Going to the caps, back on slides 9, 10, 11, and through there, there's one cap that's $511 a day and the other that's $200 a day. It wasn't clear to me whether that includes the cost of the health care benefits or whether that was the wage cap, and in addition, you got the health care.
That's the wage cap, and then in addition to that, you get the health care.
Okay. Second question relates to the rules on the deferral of estimated tax payments. It's just a quirk, but I'm sure it wasn't intentional, but it seems fairly obvious to me how you would use it. Since they've deferred the first quarter estimated payments to July 15th, but they haven't done anything with the second quarter estimated payments, it makes sense to me that, let's just assume for the moment to keep it simple, that I was planning to pay in, you know, $1,000 for each of those quarters. It seems like I ought to wait, not pay anything with my second quarter, but pay $2,000 with my first quarter payment in July. And then if you have to fill out a 2210, which is the penalty format, or the penalty form, you put the $2,000 into the first quarter payment calc, and the extra carries over to second quarter. So, in effect, they have deferred the second quarter payment to July 15th, but I'm not sure the IRS has figured that out yet.
Huh. Is that something that we've flagged for them?
Not me.
Okay. Yeah, if you can send me an email, we can send them a note, and I'm sure that they'd be eager to make, you know, provide some clarity on that. So.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking about my own personal estimated tax payment.
Sure.
It's like I'd be nuts to pay anything in the second quarter.
Right, exactly. So, but I don't want to, you know, create a scenario that's worse for taxpayers, but, you know, if there's something that we can flag for them that, you know, helps everybody out, let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Say, this is Ed. I'll just throw out, I do know that the AICPA, in a letter to Treasury, was questioning whether you could do something similar, but essentially make an additional payment as part of an extension and use that as a backdoor to pushing your second quarter out. So it could be that we'll see something along those lines,
okay,
or maybe in that FAQ that they're
updating. Yeah,
okay.
That would be
so
another
they are
way
considering
to do the
it.
Same thing.
Right.
I haven't read it yet, but one of the firms cited to me Revenue Procedure 99-4 for the proposition that we cannot do that, you know, pay it with the extension and have it account in this. But I don't know. I haven't read it yet. It's Revenue Procedure 99-4.
No. All right. Well, it does sound like, you know, if Bob, if you could just send me two paragraphs on this, I'll forward it on to the guys at Treasury and just see what they're going to do.
Okay.
I'd like to circle back on the question of corporations who pay rents to LLCs that own the real estate in small business arrangements. I think this is probably pretty common. Even though they're closely held by basically the same individual. Do you think, I think your answer was that you didn't see any reason why those wouldn't be qualify for forgiveness or qualify through the SBA program. Am I clear in that?
There are a number of circumstances that I think if they had, you know, sat down and thought about this for 6 months, that we might have seen more in the way of exceptions. You know, you also take the situation where, you know, I'm a software developer. I'm the only guy that works for my company, and I'm my W-2s, but I've got a corp out there, and that's what I'm doing, and I'm paying this wages to myself, and it's just similar to what you're talking about. It's covered, and the reason I'm suggesting that it may very well continue to be covered, and they're not going to try to close what some might call a loophole. I'm not sure it is because, you know, they went out of their way to include independent contractors which is precisely that. In other words, people paying themselves. And so as a consequence, there was certainly nothing in the bill, you know, in this entire title that changed that rule. And I don't think they're going to try to change that, although with 2020 hindsight, they might wish they would have.
No, but I concur that the sense of urgency probably makes good sense that we would apply sooner than later because there's going to be a mad rush for this, $346 million or whatever it is, or $1 billion.
Oh, no, it's much better than that. It's $349
billion. Yeah.
Which isn't I'm kidding. That's not that big of a number.
For what's being offered, I absolutely think that there's going to be a run on the bank, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I checked with one of our S-Corp banks, and they are looking to offer these loans ASAP, looking to make hundreds of these loans. This guy is not a loan officer, so he doesn't know the specifics, but the bottom line is that I think there's an intense interest by banks to make these loans available. I do think the $350 billion is a leveraged amount, though. That's the capital amount. It's not the amount of the loans. I think the amount of loans could be a lot more than that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So hopefully, you know, the $350 is sufficient to deal with demand for these. But my expectation is that there's going to be a lot of demand for these, you know, just based on feedback like that. But, you know, as Tom says, you know, get in there quickly so that you're at the front of the line because, you know, like the UI offices, my guess is that banks are going to be a little overwhelmed for the next few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Hey, this is Ed again. A quick question, maybe since Brian and Tom, you've been spending more time on this than I have, but with respect to these paycheck protection loans, if you're under 500 employees, is there a reason you wouldn't do this if you're thinking some portion of it is, you know, ultimately going to be forgiven? Am I missing something?
I don't see any reason why. The only thing that slowed me down from people applying was that certification.
Yeah.
And it made me a little nervous that if your business is actually going up as a consequence of the COVID crisis, you might be a little uncomfortable making that certification.
Yeah.
Hey, have you guys
One more question?
Yeah, go, please. Please go ahead.
What happened to the personal guarantee? Is there a personal guarantee for the portion of the loan that doesn't get forgiven?
I think the loan is free of guarantees and free of collateral. And so as a consequence, the loan itself is guarantee free. So if for example, you get your figure is $250,000, just to use a number, and then you end up having only $190,000 of actual forgivable amounts, that the rest of that loan is going to stay on the books. You're going to have to pay it back. You're going to owe interest at no more than 4%, but there's no guarantee on that portion and there's no collateral.
Okay, thank you.
And what is the first day that you will be able to apply?
We don't know yet.
Or directly with a bank?
Well, actually, Brian, I think you maybe it's going to be a function of when the SBA actually gives instructions and when each bank kind of gets its act together to do it. But, Brian, you have some intelligence on that, too. Maybe you should talk.
Yeah, the SBA did a call with NFIB earlier today, and their timetable is they're going to try to get everything they need to be prepared within a week here. So my guess is starting next week, they might be able to actually start writing some of these loans.
Taking applications? Okay.
Yeah. But I would check with your bank first. My guess is they've got a legal pad somewhere with a list of names of people who've inquired, right?
Have you guys looked at the issue of rent or lease payments for non-real property, meaning for personal property? So think of the grocery store that's, you know, got a fork truck or something like that that's leased.
I'm looking at the question is whether or not it's non-real estate is covered. And I'm not, the honest answer is I did not specifically look at that question. To me, rent is rent. It's not, you know, if you say rent, unless there's a limiter, all rent would be covered, not just, it says rent include the allowable uses, says rent, that's all it says. It says rent, including rent under a lease agreement. And I don't know what that parenthetical clause, including rent under a lease agreement, means, why, you know, what it adds. But that's really all that's in the statute, and it seems to me maybe that lease agreement language was intended to cover, you know, a vehicle lease agreement or something else. But I think rent's rent, and it's not limited to real estate. And the mortgage loan interest may or may not be based on what I was describing earlier.
Thanks.
Hey, Tom, back to your question on why you wouldn't do the PPP loan, back to Brian's, you know, chart, which is really great, linking all the programs together. I mean, one reason not to do the payroll protection loan is that you can't do the employee retention tax credit if you do the loan. And as I read it, if you do the loan forgiveness, you can't do the delayed payroll tax payments. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, that's a good point. My answer was not as nuanced as it should have been. Yeah, there are certain things that qualifying for the payment, and it doesn't say qualifying, you know, it's pro rata. If you qualify for $10,000 of forgiveness, and it knocks you out of any one of these other programs, that would be a reason not to. That's a better answer. And that would be just a matter of, you know, calculating which benefit is worth more to you.
Does that mean, Tom, that if you get a PPP loan but don't ask for the forgiveness, can you still do the payroll tax deferment?
I think you could, because, and now here I'm relying on Brian's chart, but I think it's the loan forgiveness that triggers your exclusion from those other programs. But that's based on Brian's chart.
Yeah, just in that case, just with the delayed payroll tax payment. For the employee retention credit program, I think it's participation in the loan if you get the loan.
Yeah,
so
I think
that's
right. The
language is different. Yeah.
Yeah,
but the language is different. To Ed's point, even if you're taking the delayed payroll tax payments, right? This loan, you get, what, up to $10 million. It's a 10-year loan. It's 4% interest rate. You know, this would be a time to have an extra $10 million in your pocket, and the worst thing that happens is that you have to pay it back, right? Even if you're going to take the payroll tax deferment and other things. So it strikes me that, you know, if you're eligible for these loans, the base case is go get one of these loans and, you know, work out the rest later. That kind of quieted everybody up. We had a good conversation going there. Any other questions?
I've got a question.
Okay.
How does the increased UI payments reduce the forgiveness available under the PPP program?
Well, the key is that you're maintaining your payroll tax. This is me. I'm just inferring that, but you're maintaining your payroll, and that's the key component to getting your loans forgiven. Well, if you have people going on to UI, then you're not maintaining your payroll. Am I missing something there, Tom?
They're either unemployed or they're not.
So there's no direct mechanical relationship between UI payments for people you lose and the PPP, because it seems to me that, as I recall it, there are ways to, in effect, restore your position with respect to reduction of your workforce.
You can, but I believe it's for layoffs that you had prior to the loan program being in place. In other words, if over the last 2 weeks you've laid people off, you now have access to these loans. As part of getting the loan, you rehire those people. I think that's where the forgiveness comes in. I don't think the forgiveness comes in where, you know, you fire them a month from now and then you rehire them 2 months from now. I don't think it works like that.
I believe you have to do that within 30 days of enactment.
Yeah.
What if I bring these people back under the payroll protection, but I don't have anything for them to do? Do I just buy a bunch of coloring books and have them sit at their desk?
I think that's the challenge, right?
Pretty much.
And frankly, I think that's, you know, one of the reasons why you have this shotgun approach here, is that not every solution is going to work for every employer. And, you know, Congress was aware of the scale and, you know, the scope of what we're dealing with here. So they were trying to offer up lots of different solutions that might fit for different circumstances.
And I think the goal of this approach was, you know, to the extent that there are functional and good working relationships between employers and employees, if at all possible, even if it costs a bunch of money, which is what we're talking about here, if at all possible, let's keep those functioning and good relationships in place so that when we get past this crisis, things are still working as well as they were before. To me, the coloring books may be an answer that's consistent with that as a rationale.
Yeah, I mean, I in my particular business model, you know, I could divert. I have people that have multiple skill sets, and rather than do the job that they were doing because there isn't any work in that particular capacity, I might have them paint the building or, you know, do something like that. But they're still under, you know, the payroll so that when, you know, the gate opens back up, we can hit the ground running. And I see the wisdom in that.
Yeah, that's definitely the challenge, is how do you make it so that once we're past this, you know, the economy can get up to speed just as quickly as possible. And that means that you don't have to go out and rehire a bunch of people, right? So that's what this program's designed to do.
Yeah, I trained a lot of highly skilled people that are very individualized in their skill sets. And there was poaching going on, you know, a month ago for these employees with, you know, all sorts of hire-on bonuses and signing bonuses, et cetera. And, you know, I've got years of training in these people, and I certainly didn't want to train them for the competition. But, you know, if I need to have them tread water so that they don't stray, so that when the gate is open, you know, we can come out gangbusters, that would certainly be my goal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, perfect. And that's what the program's designed to do. So hopefully it'll work.
If that's the intention, then, like I said, I'll just buy a lot of coloring books.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you could come up with some make-work projects in there somewhere, right?
No, I do. I was being facetious, but the relevancy of it is really the same, you know.
Right.
With all the
I have somebody that can write computer code, and I'm going to have them paint the office walls, you know.
Right. We've gone a little bit over here, but this has been an excellent discussion. Maybe one or two more questions, if there anybody out there. If not, I want to thank everybody, and particularly Tom. He put in a tremendous amount of work, as you can tell, on this presentation and did it over the weekend. So, Tom, thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, for participating. I think as you get the idea, I mean, they've thrown a bunch of stuff at this problem, and now the challenge is to make sure that the execution is up to speed so that these programs work effectively. Educational calls like that, I hope, will help with that. So we're going to continue this in the future. So be on the lookout for more calls and more Washington Wires and all the rest, and we'll try to keep you educated on what's going on and what the programs are doing. So thanks, everybody, and we'll be in touch soon.
Thanks for your work.
Thank you.